Okay, good morning, everybody. Good. I think we were gonna start with some recitations. Okay. Is it too warm? Are people gonna fall asleep? Yeah, could we turn the heat down a little bit? Otherwise everybody's including me. Yeah, our flight was delayed 5 hours, so we didn't get in. We got to bed at like 1:30 or something. So if I fall asleep in the middle of the sentence, you'll already be asleep and you won't notice. Okay, so shall we do the recitations? So focus on your breath, letting your breath be natural and relaxed. And put your attention either at your belly or at the upper lip and the nostrils. And simply observe your breath. If you get distracted, bring your attention back. And this way, let the mind calm down. And then let's take a moment and cultivate our motivation. And in this hustle and bustle city, let's appreciate the time and opportunity we have to calm our mind, to look inside of ourselves, to learn how to discern what is wholesome or virtuous, and what is unwholesome and or non-virtuous. And also to learn the techniques for increasing the former and subduing the latter. And together with the great opportunity we have comes a responsibility to not be self-centered about it, and to remember that we have this opportunity due to the kindness of others, and thus to have a wish to repay that kindness, and specifically to repay it by advancing on the path to full awakening, by doing all the practices that are necessary to really purify our mind and enlarge our heart and grow our capabilities, so that instead of putting band-aids on problems, we'll be able to really address the fundamental issues and solve them. So with this aspiration for full awakening, then let's share the Dharma together today. Ding. Okay, so it's good to be here with you. It's good to get off the plane. So I think the topic for today, as far as I understand it, is things that people have difficult, that Westerners have difficulty in understanding about the Buddha Dharma. Is that what you're expecting? Although maybe you don't have any difficulties understanding anything. Maybe the whole thing makes complete sense to you. The whole worldview is, you know, not problematic at all. So I'd really like to hear from you too, as we're spending the day together, what issues specifically you want me to talk about. I have some guesses about what might be difficult for you based on what was difficult for me. But, you know, you may have some other things. So, tell me, what's... Everybody understand rebirth? Nobody has any doubts about rebirth? Really? Okay, good. Maybe I don't need to give a talk. Yeah, yes. Okay, so relying on a spiritual mentor and karma. What else? Yeah.
Attachment to children.
Attachment to kids. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so a balanced Dharma life as a layperson.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about purification.
Okay, purification.
Understanding the self.
Understanding the self. Or how about the lack of...
Yeah.
Okay, how to think about the self. Or how not to think about the self. Yeah. Yeah, so emptiness, but she's, yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
I don't understand how you can say that the person has inherent qualities that are positive.
Oh, okay. So how we can say that there are, people have positive qualities as part of their nature. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Uh-huh.
Calm,
Okay. So when the world around you is nuts, how to keep from joining in? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Seeing problems as sources of happiness.
Okay. Seeing problems as sources of happiness, huh? Ah, okay, so being a Buddhist when the main culture isn't, this kind of relates to your question. Okay. Why don't I start with that one? Okay, and then I couldn't remember the whole list that you gave, but so bring them up again, you know, as we kind of meander through different topics. Okay, so how to structure a Dharma practice, right, as a lay person, and be a Buddhist in a society when everybody, almost everybody around you thinks you're nuts. And when you go to work on Monday morning and people say to you, what did you do over the weekend? And you said, well, Saturday I went to a Buddhist course. And they go, what? Why did you do that? You know, you say, well, I want to learn to meditate. And they say, you just sat there and looked at your belly button all day Saturday? You know, what kind of ridiculousness is this? Yeah, or are you in a cult? Right? Yeah, yeah. My parents thought I was in a cult. Yeah. So they thought I was getting brainwashed. That they were right on. I wanted to get brainwashed. Because my brain was pretty dysfunctional. So that part they were right. The cult part they were right. Okay. I think one of the elements that's really important, you know, in being a Buddhist in the West in a fast society is to be really confident in yourself about your own practice and confident in your refuge. Yeah, because if we're not clear about what our path is, we're not clear what the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha are and why we rely on them, then when people question us, we don't know what to say and we ourselves begin to have doubts. Okay, so I think, you know, really... spending some time on the four truths of the Aryas, yeah, mistranslated as the Four Noble Truths. I say mistranslated, you know, well, okay, the first one they say is truth of suffering, which is also a wrong translation. but then, yeah, then you have people say, well, the Buddha said life is suffering, and that's noble. What? What? Excuse me? This is why I left Christianity. You know? Yeah. Please don't give me this kind of stuff. So when it says four noble truths, noble means Arya beings. Those are the beings who see reality directly. Yeah? So what are truths in the perspective of beings who see reality directly? And one of the first truth that they see is that there are unsatisfactory conditions in our life. Okay? Unsatisfactory conditions is kind of a long phrase. The Sanskrit and Pali word is dukkha. So it's often easier just to say dukkha. If we can remember karma, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we can also remember dukkha. Okay? So it just means unsatisfactory conditions. I think everybody would agree with that. Because if everything in our life were hunky-dory, you wouldn't be here this morning. Right? Yeah. So everybody came because we are all acknowledging that, you know, here we are alive. We want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. But we can't, you know, make the world conform to what we think is going to make us happy. Okay? And then we spent some time really acknowledging that as our basic situation, and also acknowledging that we are subject to aging, sickness, and death, and that that isn't, you know, our idea of a good time, and that there's no way science is going to, you know, prevent that. Yeah, we can spend all the money we want, you know, doing research, but, you know, there's no way to overcome aging, sickness, and death because it's the very nature of a body like this. Yeah. And it's something that in our society we do not like to think about or talk about, and we are in big denial about it. And most of what you see all around you in Manhattan is all about, you know, and let's prevent aging, sickness, and death. And somehow, you know, we're going to get everything we want and look like all those people, you know, whose faces are as big as the wall looking out at you, you know, however they're doing it. I mean, the whole thing's really rather ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah? And yet, we buy into it. So, yeah. So just the fundamental nature of a life in what we call cyclic existence. And then the causes of it, yeah, believe it or not, this is hard to believe, or hard not to believe. It is not the U.S. Congress, okay? Although they are a close runner-up to ignorance, anger, and attachment, okay? But, you know, external beings are not the causes of our misery and our confusion. You know, the source lies inside here. So we can rearrange the external world all we want to, but that's not going to mean that anything changes. Yeah, it's on. Okay, so seeing the causes as internal mental afflictions, yeah. And then, yeah, contemplating that there is a cessation of all of this because the cause can be eliminated. Okay, and this is the important point right in here, that the cause can be eliminated, and how can it be eliminated? And His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, stresses this again and again, how important it is to really contemplate this and gain some certainty about it. Because if we're not really sure that the cause of cyclic existence can be eliminated, then we're not going to have much enthusiasm for practicing the path. Okay? So, ignorance misapprehends things. It apprehends things or grasps things in the opposite way from the way they really exist. Okay, so we're coming into your questions here. That things exist dependent on other factors, don't you think? Yeah? I mean, we look at the altar here, it exists dependent on the materials it's made out of, dependent on the people who made it. Okay? Even we, as living beings, yeah, we always try and be, this is the American dream, to be independent. And it is truly a dream because it does not exist. Yeah, we are not independent beings. We like to have this idea of picking ourselves up by our own bootstraps, and I am an individual, yeah. And I'm going to have control over everything. And it's really, that's not the way things exist at all, is it? You know, everything exists in dependence on other factors. You know, things are produced by causes and conditions.
Things have parts. We also, you know, conceive and label of things. They don't have some inherent nature that makes them what they are, but ignorance thinks they do. Yeah? So when ignorance looks at our body and mind, for example, it thinks, I am here. Yeah? And that person I'm attached to is also there, real person. And the person whose guts I hate, also real person. You know? And yet, actually, when, you know, when you search, what are you going to point to that you can identify as the real you? Or the real other person, or the real anything? Yeah, because when you search to find what exactly words refer to, all you find is a collection of different parts that our minds put together and gave it a name, and then it becomes an object. But ignorance doesn't apprehend things that way. Ignorance apprehends them like they have their own nature, something inside them that makes them what they are, including ourselves. Okay? So because ignorance misapprehends things, yeah, when we generate the wisdom that sees things as they are, that wisdom can overpower the ignorance. Okay? So if things had their own inherent nature, then ignorance would not be a wrong consciousness. It would be a correct one and could not be eliminated. But because things are empty of having some solid objective existence, therefore wisdom can be developed that sees things as they are, and that can overcome the ignorance. And when ignorance is overcome, then the attachment, anger, jealousy, resentment, rebelliousness, envy, arrogance, laziness, lack of integrity. Shall I go on? All these things that are internal to us can no longer stand up because they're all based on this ignorant view. Okay? So there exists a state beyond that, and there exists, that's the third noble truth, and there, the fourth noble truth is there exists a path, you know, how a way of transforming our mind so that our mind becomes in accord with reality, and that leads us to that state of freedom. Okay? So I think we, you know, have some confidence in this in order to really hold a Dharma practice together in this country, because everything around us is trying to tell us the opposite. Isn't it? Yeah? I mean, everything in New York is you can stay young and beautiful forever. Right. Sure. Yeah? But we say, well, maybe, yeah, if I only get that kind of perfume, you know, if I only get this, that, or the other thing, then. Yeah. And so to be able to see all of that as the hallucination and hype that it is and not get caught up in it, and to have a strong mind that really knows what our values are, what our priorities are, what is important in life, and then to stay with that. Yeah? And another, so having clarity in our own mind about the path and the Four Noble Truths, and, sorry, the Four Truths seen as true by the Aryas, and... And also to not care so much what other people think about us. Yeah? This is a really important part of holding together a practice. Yeah? Because if we are very sensitive and we want to be people to praise us, we want people to approve of us, we want to have a good reputation in our family, in our workplace, amongst our friends. Yeah, if this is something that is really important to us, it is very easy for it to become more important than our own values and priorities. And that becomes more, our reputation and people's approval becomes more important to us than anything else. And then we spend our lives trying to meet other people's expectations, trying to gain their approval, trying to get them to love us and respect us and appreciate us and tell us what we're doing is wonderful. And that's not going to happen. Okay? So especially if you're trying to follow a path that's a bit different than society. Yeah? Is society going to go whippy? No, it's going to go, you're nuts. Yeah, you're out of your mind. You're just looking at your belly button when you meditate. Yeah, you want to have a simple lifestyle? What? You're giving up your smartphone? That is too much. Absolutely too much. You cannot live without a smartphone. It's glued to your hand anyway. You can't get rid of it, you know. And there's no way to be happy without it. Huh? And people are going to tell you you're crazy. When you say, I want to live a simple lifestyle because I want to devote more time to my spiritual practice. Or I want to devote more time to being of benefit to other sentient beings. They're going to say, what? Yeah, don't you know that money is the meaning of life? That the more money you make, money indicates success. If you have money, it means you're successful. And that's what New York is all about, isn't it? Everybody comes to this city to be successful. And money is your primary way of illustrating it, according to society. And that's a bunch of hogwash, isn't it? Yeah. But if that's the milieu around you, and if that's what your friends believe and your family believes, and you want them to approve of you, then pretty soon you start thinking like them. Yeah? And then your determination to wake up in the morning to meditate is out the window. Okay? So, you know, I think these are some really important components, and it takes some time to develop them. Yeah, it really takes time. And often we fall down a number of times. Yeah. So I think those are important factors. Also recognizing the incredible fortune we have to be able to meet the Dharma and have access to the Dharma and to teachings and teachers and books and a center and everything else, you know. To really see that as a precious opportunity and to remember that it doesn't last forever. Yeah, and so to take advantage of it while it's there instead of saying mañana en la mañana, you know. But really to use this opportunity now. Does that make some sense? Yeah? Let me give you a few practical things along that line. Because I think setting up a daily practice is quite important for maintaining some continuity. One thing that's very good, in your calendar, on your smartphone. Yeah? If your smartphone's really smart. Oops. Then you set a little time every day and it rings, and that is the time it says in it, appointment with the Buddha. Okay? So every morning, for however long you decide, 15 minutes, half an hour, an hour, whatever is reasonable for you, you have an appointment with the Buddha. Okay? Now, are you going to stand up an appointment with the Buddha? Are you going to not show up? Yeah? So if you have an appointment with the Buddha every morning, you're going to go to bed a little bit earlier in the evening instead of staying up to watch the talk shows or the movies or whatever, yeah? You're going to make sure that you are awake and eager and in a good state of mind for your appointment with the Buddha, because that's not something you want to blow. Okay? So if you really write it in your diary, appointment with the Buddha, and that is your meditation time. Yeah? And maybe you want to do some practice in the evening too. So that's good. Yeah? Then another practical thing, when you first wake up in the morning, take refuge in the three jewels and generate your motivation. Okay, and so you can do this even before you stumble out of bed. Yeah, you say, today as much as possible, I'm not going to harm anybody. And today as much as possible, I'm going to benefit others. And I'm going to keep that bodhicitta motivation in my heart with whatever I do during the day. Yeah. And so you make that your first thought in the morning. And that sets the tone for the whole day. And then periodically throughout the day you come back to your motivation. Yeah, again and again and again. And that really helps to keep you on track. Okay. So maybe, you have your smartphone ding, every so often. And that is a motivation ding. Yeah. Pause for a minute, come back to my motivation of bodhicitta, of non-harmfulness, of kindness. Okay. So that's also another very practical help during your day. And then also, I think it's really important to go to teachings. So whenever you have the opportunity, go to teachings. Yeah. Even if it means, that you have to travel for a whole half an hour. You probably travel longer than that to get to work. I'm going to work to make money. Ooh. But Dharma, I have to go across town. It should be just the opposite, okay? Yeah, so go to teachings. And then every few months go on a retreat. Yeah? And if you can't go to teachings or can't go to retreat, go online. But online is not a substitute for actual personal connection. Okay, it's an enhancer to personal connection with the teacher, but it's not a substitute for it. Okay, does that answer your question and your question? Okay. Now, karma. Karma simply means action. Yeah, that's all it means, is action. And we are acting all the time, okay? Our thoughts, our mental actions, yeah? Our intentions, our mental actions, our mouth, and any way we communicate is called verbal actions. And then the actions of our body are physical actions, yeah? So we're acting a lot. There's a lot of action going on. And because cause and effect is the underlying principle of how things relate on a conventional level, yeah, then whatever we do has effects. Yeah. Whatever we do arises from previous causes. Whatever we do has effects in the future. And specifically, they, our actions and the effects they bring have an ethical dimension to them. Okay? So it's not just like, you know, we do that, that we do something and then what happens to us next is the only effect of that action. Okay? So often, you know, what we do, what happens next is an effect of the action, an immediate effect. But sometimes the effects of our actions come way, way, way down the stream, don't they? Even in this life, even in, you know, yeah, you get an injury, you do something dangerous when you're young, you're injured, and it affects how you feel when you're 80 years old. Okay, somebody was telling me that they had some sports injuries when they were in high school, and then now they're having a hip replacement or a knee replacement, yeah? So even, you know, on a one-life basis, the results don't always come immediately after the actions. And on an ethical basis, they don't either, yeah? And so they may ripen in a future lifetime. And in the same way, the you know, what we're experiencing now is a result of many previous causes, some of which were created in previous lifetimes. Okay? Because things don't happen by chance. If things happen by chance, then why do you eat breakfast in the morning? Okay? We eat breakfast because we have the assumption that it will stop the hunger and it will nourish our body. We eat for a cause, for a reason. Yeah. If things happen randomly, then the elimination of hunger and the nourishment of the body would just happen randomly, and you wouldn't eat for that purpose. Okay? So just on basic daily things, we believe in cause and effect, and we do things to accomplish certain purposes. Yeah. The thing is that we're not always aware of the ethical dimension of our actions, and we focus exclusively on the immediate results and on the physical results, or the results that we can see, you know, or experience with our senses. Whereas we're not so in tune with the mind, you know, and what's going on inside of us, because we're so distracted, you know, by sense objects. But if we look at the mind, you know, we can begin to see how cause and effect works in the mind. No, when we think certain thoughts, it produces certain feelings in us later. When we have certain intentions, they motivate particular actions which bring results. Okay. So that's the whole idea of karma and its effects. It's not magic. Yeah, His Holiness says that sometimes we use the word karma as if it were magic. You know, somebody said, "Wow, why did that happen to somebody?" And we say, "Oh, it was their karma." In other words, I don't know. Yeah, we said, "Oh, it's karma. I don't know." Now, karma doesn't mean I don't know. Yeah. The law of karma means I created the cause, and there's nobody else to blame. Yeah. that I'm the one who created the cause for my experience. Yeah. And it's quite interesting in our lives, whenever we have some unpleasant experience, we go, why me? Why does this always happen to me? When we have happiness, nobody ever goes, why me? Yeah? We say, of course, I deserve more. Okay. But the question of why me should be applied to happiness as well. Yeah? Why did we have food to eat this morning and many people don't? Yeah? And it's not simply because the grocery store is nearby, yeah, or because of the economic system or, you know, whatever like that. Yeah. There's a deeper question. Why were we born in a place with this economic system? Why were we born in a place where there was ample food? Did you ever wonder that? As a kid, I always wondered, why was I born me? Did you wonder that? Yeah, why was I born me? Why wasn't I born somebody else? Yeah, and you can't say it's just random or by accident. Yeah. And so, these are things that are ripened results of our previous actions. Okay, so cause and effect functions. So our actions will influence who or what we are born as. Yeah? They influence the kind of habitual actions we engage in. They influence the circumstances that we encounter in our life and how we respond to them. They influence what kind of environment we're born into. Okay? So all of this is influenced by our own actions, by our own intentions and our motivations. Yeah? So of course there's external conditions that play a role. But, you know, primary cause comes from inside here. Okay? Take, for example, all of you are interested in Buddhism. Yeah? How many of you were raised as Buddhists? Not one. Okay. How many of you have Buddhist ancestors somewhere in your genes? Were there Buddhists? Okay, so two people, yeah, had ancestors who were Buddhists. So it doesn't look likely that the nature part of it caused the interest in Buddhism, yeah, because by far the majority, it's not the case. Okay, and the nurture part, yeah, growing up Buddhist in a Buddhist family or whatever. Nobody had that. So, you know, in society, we usually talk about nature and nurture. If you look at nature and nurture, why are we all here? If they're the only factors involved, two people have ancestors, yeah, that were Buddhists. The rest of us didn't. Nobody had a Buddhist upbringing. So why are we all here if there's only nature and nurture? Yeah, why are we here? Then it doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, we must have done something right somewhere along the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
One thing is because we probably all have questioning minds. Yeah,
well, we have questioning minds. But why did we wind up in a Buddhist center? Yeah. It's quite interesting when you look at it. I mean, there's any number of other religious things that we could have looked at because of our questioning minds. Yeah. So there's got to be some other factor besides just biology and environment. Okay. How many of you are parents? Our parents, yeah. Okay. Those of you who are parents, did your kids have personalities when they were first born, or did they come out as empty slates? Huh? They have personalities from day one, don't they? Yeah. They have personalities. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we don't come out as blind slates, blank slates. Yeah. There's some tendencies there. Even though we haven't learned anything. Yeah. Why? Why do kids have tendencies, personalities, even as infants? Yeah. Why are some people drawn towards one thing and other people drawn towards another thing? Yeah. There's got to be reasons to all of this. And I don't think it's our brain. Yeah. I'm sure our brain has some relationship to what's going on. Yeah. But I don't think the brain or the genes are the principal cause of this kind of thing. Yeah. So in our society, I mean, we rely so much on physicality, materiality, and I think we're missing out on, you know, really recognizing other kinds of causes. Yeah. So what could those other kinds of causes be? Well, what the Buddha has explained is the actions or karma that we created in the past. Yeah. So even as an infant, you know, karma we created in previous lives and beginningless previous lives, because there was no beginning. Yeah. Now we like the idea of a beginning. Okay. There's got to be a beginning. Okay. But if you know, all of us know from math class, on either way you go on the number line, you're not going to find a beginning or an end. Yeah. Either way you go, you know, always one more. If you look up into the universe, you know you're not going to come to a brick wall that is the end of the universe. And even if there were a brick wall, there's got to be something on the other side of it. Otherwise, why would you build one? Yeah. So if we really think about it, there can't be a beginning, there can't be an end, you know, of things that have the causes to produce the next moment of them. Yeah. So we have to look beyond this lifetime and to causes, you know, beyond this lifetime. Because just looking at factors in this life, we cannot explain what happens to us and who we are. Yeah, it's impossible to explain. Hmm? Yeah. I mean, if it were only nature and nurture, we would have turned out like our parents. Yeah. And all the siblings would be very much alike. I don't know about your family, but my family, wow. You know, we are very, very different. Okay, why? Okay, so these are the kinds of things that have to have causes, and we refer to our previous actions, especially our intentions, the mental actions that we do. Because without the mental intentions, the mouth doesn't move and the body doesn't move. I mean, unless you have a reflex reaction. But You know, most of all of our voluntary actions depend on intentions, don't they? So intention is really the key to it. And intention is a mental factor in the mind. Okay? And then what kinds of intentions do we have? What other mental factors are accompanying the mental factor of intention? You know, one moment we're full of love. The next moment we're really angry. And the moment after that we want to go to sleep. And the moment after that there's some nice thing and we're wide awake. And we want to go after an object of attachment. So when we look, we see, you know, so many intentions, one after the other, and so many actions, one after the other. And our intentions, you know, are really what set the stage for the verbal communication, the actions of our body, you know, both virtuous and non-virtuous. And then these leave, for lack of a better word, energy traces. Don't like saying that, but it's vague enough. Yeah. Or you could say seeds, but seeds are not anything material. Okay. So some kind of traces of energy, some kind of possibility for the future. Yeah. An action happened, and the fact that that action happened is going to influence the future. The having happened of the action is going to influence the future. Okay. So, yeah, we have these karmic energies, karmic seeds, karmic having happens, you know, and that connect the intention of our action with some kind of experience that we're going to have later on. Okay. And so karma works in that way. So actually, yeah, karma doesn't mean I don't know. Karma means that we have the ability to create the kind of future we want, but not necessarily immediately, because we have a lot of karmic seeds from the past that are playing a role in our present existence. But we can influence what karmic seeds ripen and what karmic seeds don't ripen. Okay, so we can influence the cooperative conditions for karmic traces to ripen. And we can create the kind of karmic traces, karmic energies or seeds, whatever you want to call them, for the future, that will ripen in the future. Okay? So if you say, well, how can I influence what karma ripens now? That's by watching what we choose to do right now, what environments we put ourselves into, what actions we do right now. They become also not only the causes for things in future lives, but also the conditions for karmic ripening in this life. Okay? So if you go out and drink and drug, for example, okay? Yeah? New Yorkers like to do that. You go out and you drink and drug. Okay? And then you get in a car and drive. Yeah. Is it going to be easier or more difficult for you to have an accident? Easier. Okay? So, what we do right now creates an environment whereby if we have the karma from previous times to get in an accident, we're creating right now the environment for that karma to ripen in. Okay? If you choose to come to the Dharma Center, you're putting yourself in a situation where some good seeds from previous lives to learn the Dharma have the opportunity to ripen. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so is this the concept of karma similar to the New Age concept, like your thoughts create your reality, or is it different?
Well, yes, your thoughts create your reality or influence your reality, but I don't know that the way Buddhists think of that is the same way as the New Age people do. Okay? I'm usually fairly skeptical of New Age. Also because I don't know what it means. You know, it's like everybody has their own theory. Yeah, what this means in Buddhism is, you know, how we look at situations, you know, what we think, how we describe something to ourselves will influence how we experience the situation. But that's not the only factor involved. Okay? Yeah. And from a Buddhist viewpoint, you don't give yourself cancer by being angry. Okay, so don't think like that. Yeah, that's coming from some previous karma. However, if we have a very negative state of mind, it provides the environment for, you know, past negative karma to ripen. Okay.
So when unfortunate things happen to me, and I say, well, that's your karma, it always kind of got this baggage that said, well, you're getting punished for something that you did in the future. So it's really that karma is
in the past.
It doesn't have any kind of punishment or reward.
Yeah. Yeah. There's absolutely no idea of punishment and reward in Buddhism. Some translators put those words in, but it's, again, incorrect translation. It's just a thing of, you know, when you plant roses, you get roses. And when you plant cabbage, you get cabbage. You know, that you get results that correspond to the cause. And there's no external manager of the universe who's controlling the whole thing and dishing out rewards and punishments. Okay, yeah. Okay, so is it attachment to do good actions because we want good results karmically, like in future lives? I wouldn't call that attachment. I would call that wisdom. Yeah. There might be an element of attachment for my good results in my future life. So there might be some attachment to future lives, good results. But that certainly is better than the attachment we have for the pleasure of this life right now. Because the attachment for the pleasure of this life right now leads us to create a lot of harmful actions. Whereas the attachment to having good lives, you know, is not going to lead us to do any harmful actions right now. It's a good motivation. It's limited in that it would be better to aspire for full liberation for samsara or for the awakening of a Buddha. You know, those are higher things to aspire for. But simply, you know, but aspiring to create good causes for good results in a future life, that's much better than the way most people live right now. Yeah. So that's actually considered the first step on the path, the first kind of good motivation to create. Okay. And then, of course, we try and expand our motivation to go beyond that. Okay. Makes some sense? Okay. Yeah.
Well,
That's La La Land. Okay? You know, I mean, I can see, I can sit here and think, I want to fly, I want to fly, I want to fly. Am I going to be able to fly? No. Okay? You know, so just by sitting, you know, I sit here and dream, oh, I'm lying on the beach with Buddha Boy. You know, you know, is that going to make that happen? You know, Prince Charming, I'm dreaming of Prince Charming, I'm dreaming of Prince Charming. Is that going to make Prince Charming show up? No. Okay? Yeah. It's going to make me impute Prince Charming onto some guy. But it's not going to make him from his side Prince Charming. Okay? But, yeah. But, having said that, a positive attitude does help. Okay? Because when we have what Lama Yeshe used to call poor quality view, and we just say, oh, I'm such a failure. I can't do anything right. Nobody loves me. I'm really dumb. I don't understand things. People are better than me. When we think like that, yeah, we're limiting our possibilities by the way we think. Because when we have that view of ourselves, we aren't going to even try to do things that we could be successful at. We aren't going to try new things. We're shooting ourselves in the foot. Yeah. Whereas if we think of ourselves, you know, I'm an intelligent person, that doesn't mean I have to be the most intelligent person on the planet. But I have reasonable intelligence. I have curiosity. I have a creative mind. Yeah, I can try new things. I can study. I can learn. Yeah, if you have that kind of way of thinking, then you're going to be more successful because you're going to give yourself a chance. Okay? Yeah. An example I always give regarding this and about how our thoughts create our reality. Okay. But you see, thoughts creating our reality, it doesn't mean that only our thoughts create it. It's going to depend on past karma. It's going to depend that, you know, you could be in prison and think they're going to release me, they're going to release me, they're going to release me, and they're not going to release you. Yeah. So just thinking that way doesn't make things happen on the outside. Okay. But how we view things will influence how we experience. So if you come into a place like this, or any place, a party, a workplace, doesn't matter, where you don't know anybody, and if you have the mind of like, I don't know anybody, and they probably all know each other and they're friends, and I don't know if they're going to like me, and anyway, I may not like them, and I'm not going to fit in, and what am I going to talk with people about, and you know, If you think like that, you're going to have one experience when you go into a room full of strangers. Yeah. If you have the thought of, well, I don't know anybody, but, you know, there's going to be a lot of people there who have really interesting lives, and I can learn about their lives and ask them questions, and this is going to be fun going in a place where I don't know anybody. Yeah. And there's probably going to be some shy people who will really appreciate if I talk to them. Then you're going to go in and you're going to have a totally different experience because of the way you're thinking. Okay? So it's in that kind of way that our thoughts are going to influence our experience. Yeah? Not that we can will ourselves to have a job. Okay? Yeah? Okay, so is it correct to say some attachments I've acquired and some are kind of innate, I've been born into, and in addition, I have possibilities and opportunities?
Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or safe, as I said.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because if we look, you know, a lot of our attachment, we learn, you know, our family tells us, you have to have this, you have to be this. So those are learned attachments, you know, or we're attracted to something, you know, oh, I think this cup is so beautiful because, you know, I was brought up to like pretty colors and I did, you know, so some attachments are learned. But then just the mental factor of exaggerating the good qualities of someone or something, that one is innate. Yeah, that's that we're born with. Okay. In addition, we also have certain possibilities, don't we? Yeah. And very often we don't even see our possibilities. We don't see our potentials. And instead, we just clutter our mind with all sorts of negative thoughts about ourselves that really keep us in prison. Yeah. Well, certain aspirations, you want to define your nature.
Right.
You know, if you're aspiring to develop a kind heart.
Right.
Yeah. But what you're saying is when we have aspirations and then we're disappointed for not fulfilling them. Okay? It's like, I aspire to be joyful, but I woke up in a bad mood. You know? And I aspire to have compassion, but here's this idiot in front of me. Yeah. Can't I have compassion for somebody else, not this person, you know? Okay. So this is actually what practicing the path is about. Yeah? Is, you know, we have these aspirations, and aspirations are not going to be fulfilled just by having them. Yeah? It's like, I aspire to have lunch. Yeah. So I'm just going to sit here and lunch is going to magically appear? No, I have to do something. Okay. So it's the same with these kinds of virtuous aspirations. We have to act on them and create the causes for them and be content to create the causes. Yeah. I think very often we are way too goal-oriented. So that our mind thinks, I only have pleasure, I only feel fulfilled when the goal is accomplished. And anything short of the goal means I'm disappointed and I'm a failure. Yeah? Banish that way of thinking. Yeah, it's not a very productive or realistic way of thinking. Yeah. So focusing on the result is what gets us stuck like this. Yeah. Focusing on the result is like you plant a seed and then you dig it up every day to see if it started to grow. Yeah. That's not going to work. We have to plant the seed, then water it the right amount, make sure it's in the sun. Yeah, add some fertilizer, don't step on it, create the good conditions, and it'll grow by itself. So it is with our aspirations, you know, to do the kind of actions that we need to do to make that aspiration come alive and continue. Now, at the beginning of our practice, and I think for a good while after that, our aspiration, it's not like It goes up and then it keeps going up and up and up and up and up. I mean, we are emotional yo-yos, aren't we? Our mind is fickle and unpredictable. We have very unstable minds. Yeah? I mean, all you do is watch your mind for half an hour and what you think about, what you experience. Okay? So we have to, you know, bring these aspirations to mind again and again. And then we have to do the meditations that actually support the aspiration. Okay? So, for example, if you want to develop compassion for other beings, you can't just sit there and say, compassion, compassion, compassion. That's not the way. Or I should be compassionate. I ought to be compassionate. Why isn't my heart bubbling over with compassion when I want to feel compassion? That's not going to create the compassion. Okay? Creating the compassion is going to come about when we look at others and we practice thinking they want happiness and freedom from suffering as intensely as I do. Yeah. And you practice that over and over and over again. You meditate on it in your sitting meditation. You practice it off the cushion when you look around. You know, you contemplate again on the cushion and off the cushion the kindness of other living beings. You know, so you do these kinds of meditations in a repeated fashion, and that's what creates the causes to really experience the aspirations as a living thing and for the aspirations to continue to grow. And then I'm going to tell you a secret, which is not a secret, but it's very helpful to know. Every time that you do a meditation and you don't come out feeling as uplifted as you would like to or as in tune with what the purpose of the meditation is, that does not mean that you're failing or that the meditation was useful. It's by having all those meditation sessions where you don't come out feeling moved to the bottom of your heart that create the cause for the time you do come out feeling moved to the bottom of your heart. Okay. So it's a thing of habit. It's habit. We've got to build the habit of seeing things again and again and again. Yeah. So just reminding ourselves, you know, you might sit and meditate on the kindness of others. And some mornings you really feel that, and some mornings you just go, yeah, they're so kind, but I wish they were kinder. Yeah. But it's just making that effort that keeps on planting those seeds that will make the aspiration grow. And will make the feeling grow. Okay? There's no pill to take that will do this. Okay? It's really by habit. Okay? So we have to put the time in. Okay. Why don't we take a short break right now? Stretch break, 10 minutes. Then we'll come back. We'll have some more. So, what should we go on to? You want to do what you call guru devotion? Okay. First of all, it's a wrong translation. The Tibetan is Lama Tenpa. Yeah? Lama means a teacher or a spiritual mentor. Spiritual mentor, I think, is good. Somebody who mentors us, who guides us, who teaches us, who leads us along the path. And Tenpa means to rely on. Okay, there's a big difference when you hear how to rely on a spiritual mentor and when you say guru devotion. Is there a difference for you in those words? For me, there is a huge difference what the words signal, okay? So to me, guru devotion is like, okay, there's somebody up there that, and I'm down here, and I've got to lavishly, you know, express my undying devotion. And, you know, how the Tibetans are with their tongue stuck out. That signifies respect in Tibetan culture. If you stick out your tongue, it shows that you don't have a magic, like black magic. You're not doing black magic on somebody if you stick out your tongue. It shows respect, okay? So to me, I don't know, the whole notion, what the words guru devotion mean to me, it's not something that I think, oh, I want to be like that. Yeah, personally, I don't know about you. Do you have those same connotations? Yeah. Rely on a spiritual mentor. Yes, I want to do that. I need to do that. Okay. Because I don't know what the path is. I don't know how to lead myself. I don't know all the ins and outs. Yeah, of things. And I need somebody to teach me, to guide me, to, you know, bring me back when I'm going off, you know, in the wrong direction. And I need to be mentored. Yeah. And so to me, you know, that gives a completely different idea. Okay. In all the Buddhist traditions, actually, they all talk about respecting our spiritual mentors. Yeah? And they all talk about choosing spiritual mentors carefully. Yeah. In other words, not everybody who has the title teacher, not everybody who is advertised in the New Age Gazette, yeah, with their special, you know, whatever path that they invented 2 weeks ago that is now available for $99.99 at a special discount price for you. Not all of those people are reliable spiritual guides. So the first thing is to know what are the characteristics of a reliable spiritual guide. And so that you'll know how to evaluate the, you know, the different people you meet, so you can make a wise decision about whose guidance you follow. Okay, so we're the ones who decide who our spiritual mentors are. Yeah, if somebody comes up to you and says, "You are the perfect disciple that I have always been waiting to have. It sounds good and you feel really special." Hold on to your wallet. Okay. Yeah. I mean, those people who are doing that, who are buttering you up, it is, that's not the way to form a mentor-disciple relationship. Okay, so the kind of qualities you want to look for, somebody who has good ethical conduct. Yeah, who keeps whatever level of precepts they have. Somebody who has meditative experience, who has the correct view of emptiness, who has studied the different teachings and can teach you more than one single meditation. You know, somebody who enjoys guiding others, who's compassionate and who guides people because they really care, not because they want to get a lot of offerings or have a bunch of groupies follow after them. Okay. Somebody who's quite patient, because sometimes as students we act abominably. Sorry to mention it, but we do. Yeah. And so, you know, really getting to know somebody and checking out their qualities before we form that relationship with somebody, okay? And not looking for glitz. Not, you know, when you look in the sutras for the qualifications of reliable spiritual mentors. Glitz is not one of them. Okay? Charisma is not one of them. Yeah. Because people can be very charismatic and quite manipulative and off the deep end. Okay? And glitz, you know, people with 10 million titles and big thrones and lots of brocades and the horns, you know, leading them in, that doesn't indicate that that person is necessarily a wise person. It just means there's glitz. His Holiness, you know, he kind of goes along with this, but I don't think it's his cup of tea. He tells stories about how sometimes the teachers put themselves up. You know, he says they aren't anybody in Asia, and they come to the West, and all of a sudden, you know, they're His Holiness, His Eminence, Lama Guru Rinpoche Tulku. You know, just a string of titles. You know, sometimes they become like that. And he says, so sometimes people put themselves up. Sometimes the disciples put their teachers up. And he tells stories about when there's, you know, when he's teaching or some high lama's teaching, the students will make the seats for their teacher and they'll put extra pillows under their own teacher to make him higher, you know. You know, and then, I mean, Tibetan Buddhism is full of glitz, you know. But Tibet was, if you have ever been to Tibet, you look out at Tibetan landscape for miles and don't see anything. So it makes sense in the temples, there's lots of color and lots of stuff, yeah. But that doesn't, you know, if it's done with a proper motivation of making offerings to holy beings, that's great. But, you know, not to look at that as, you know, the indicator of who is somebody you should rely on and who not. And also, it depends a lot on who we have karmic connections for. Your best friend may feel really close to one teacher, but that teacher, when they teach, doesn't resonate with you. You know, you feel, you kind of get inspired when you go to another person's teachings. So that's fine, you know. Who is your best friend's teacher doesn't have to be who your teacher is or who your mentor is. Okay, so we're the ones who get, you know, take your time, get to know people, listen to what they're saying. His Holiness advises seeing if they teach according to the general Buddhist tenets, or if they're teaching something way out. Yeah, because we want a reliable teacher, not somebody who's making up their own path. Okay? Then in terms of how we relate to that teacher, yeah, again, we're the ones who principally create the kind of relationship we want to have with our teachers. So, and it's fine to have more than one teacher. In Tibetan Buddhism, you can have more than one. And so you may find that, well, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, if, you know, if you're all going on, you know, the next few days when he's teaching, he'll be our teacher, yeah? Now, to expect to have a personal relationship with him, you know? Not so likely. But can we rely on him to teach us the path accurately? You bet. Okay. So we may, you know, refer to other of our teachers for different topics or for different kinds of questions or different kind of guidance according to, you know, where they live, how much time they have available, what kind of personality they have, you know? I know with some of my teachers, I will, there's one teacher in Dharamsala who helped me tremendously. I could ask him whenever I get stuck in how to benefit others. He has perfect advice. He's really good with that. Yeah. But others of my teachers, I wouldn't necessarily ask them those particular questions because that's maybe not their strong point. They don't like to get involved in how do you act in a specific instance, you know, to guide somebody. They aren't that kind of person, okay? So, you develop relationships, you know, according to people's dispositions and so on. Some teachers like a lot of, you know, overt, or they permit a lot of overt display of devotion. Other teachers don't like it at all. Yeah. So you have to go according to again, what your teacher likes or doesn't like. Yeah. His Holiest Dalai Lama is, you know, in public things, he's quite formal, you know, he has to be because the culture's that way. In private, you know, you go to bow to him and he says, don't bow. You know, it's like, but I have to. No. So you listen to your teacher, okay? Yeah, so, you know, some teachers see this kind of overt display as benefiting the students and they permit it. Other teachers see it maybe as getting in the way or they personally don't like it, so they say, please don't do it. So, you know, again, that doesn't have to do with the status or qualities of a teacher. It has to do more with their own personal preferences. The basic attitude of relying on a spiritual teacher is to have the attitude of, you know, this person is wise. They know things that I don't know. They can teach me the path. They can guide me on the path. They have some wisdom. You know, they have some compassion. They are a role model for what I want to become. Yeah. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean their personality, because people's personalities are different from their levels of compassion and wisdom. But when you see their compassion and wisdom, you think, I would like to be like this. This person is a good example, and they can teach me how to do that, and that's something I want to learn. And I admire and respect them for that. Okay? So they often talk about having faith in your teachers. The word that we translate as faith, is the English word faith, doesn't mean what the usual English word faith usually connotes. Because we have the idea of faith very often, that means blind faith. Yeah. Why do you believe something? I don't know. Everybody else does, or this person looks good, or it sounded good, you know, so I have faith. You know, kind of a blind belief. That's not, you know, a reliable way to depend on a spiritual mentor. Because if we have that, then as soon as the teacher does something we don't like, then we no longer have any faith. Okay? Because our definition of having faith is they do what I want them to do when I want them to do that. Okay? Yeah. So when they talk about seeing the guru as perfect or seeing the guru as Buddha, it's vastly misunderstood in the West because we take that to mean that there's some perfect being, which means they fulfill all my expectations exactly when I want that expectation to be fulfilled. Okay, is that realistic? Yeah. Here we are with fickle minds. Yeah, filled with attachment, anger, and ignorance. Is it possible for any living being to fulfill all of our expectations when our own mind is unpredictable and how we feel about others is up and down and across? Even Shakyamuni Buddha appeared in front of us we would not see the Buddha as perfect. We would find something to criticize because of our mind. Okay. So let go of that idea of this is some kind of perfect being who's going to be mommy and daddy and everything you always lacked, and they're going to fulfill all of your psychological needs. Forget it. Okay? It may happen, but don't expect that. Yeah. So it's really a thing of appreciating somebody's qualities and keeping a positive state of mind about them. Because if we let our mind go into nitpicking, we will never find an end to nitpicking. Okay? So, and the reason why it's important to keep a positive attitude towards our teachers is because if we don't, then we're not going to believe anything they tell us, which means we're going to lose out. Okay, so keeping a positive attitude isn't done for the benefit of the teacher. It's done for our benefit so that we will pay attention to what they're teaching us. Yeah. Whereas if we have, you know, this mind that's always critical and judgmental, we'll just sit there and pick faults like we do with everybody else, and we're the one who loses. Okay. Having said that, that does not mean that you say everything the teacher does is perfect, and you know, the teacher's sleeping with their students, they're embezzling money from the Dharma Center, you know, they're collapsing drunk in the middle of the Gompa, and you say, this is all the action of the Buddha, this person is the Buddha, this is perfect. You know, it doesn't mean that you are painting everything over with some false kind of blinders so that you can be the perfect disciple that is like this in your teacher's presence, okay? And I say that, you know, it's not easy to figure out, you know, what having faith in your teacher means and what relying on a spiritual mentor means. And I know for many years, you know, when I was with my teachers, I mean, I have a certain kind of personality. I don't readily accept kind of, I have to get to know something and use my own discernment before I have confidence in somebody. I'm not the kind of person who, you know, somebody else says, oh, so-and-so is a high lama, and I go in and I'm inspired by faith. No, I have to get to know them and hear their teachings and stuff. That's my personality, okay? So I used to just think, gee, there's all these people around me who have so much devotion to the teachers. They're all going, oh, my teacher is so wonderful. They're so perfect. They're Buddha. They're the incarnation of so-and-so. They're the incarnation of this and that. You know, however many previous lives they've been enlightened beings, and they're appearing before me now as the Buddha, and my hair stands on end, and I feel so moved, and, you know. And it was like I was surrounded by a bunch of people like this. You know, this was the culture around my particular teacher, the way everybody acted. And I was like, you know, I was like, I'm with this teacher. You know why I stayed with this teacher? Because what he taught me when I checked it out, it worked. When I applied what he taught me, it worked. And when I used what he taught me to look at my own mind, I realized what he was saying was right. So I kept coming back. I never, you know, I met my first teachers, you know, in 1975. I never went to them and said, will you be my teacher? You know, I just, it's like, what they say is true, what they say, you know, there's no way my ego can wiggle out around this. And it makes sense when I test it with logic. It helps me when I practice it. I keep coming back. And then everybody's like, and I'm like, you know, I'm just me. And I thought, oh, I'm not a very good student. I don't have very much guru devotion, you know. Oh, what's wrong with me there? I have so much faith and devotion. Oh, something's wrong with me. And then I began to see over the years that some of these people with so much faith and devotion kind of stopped coming. And they got lost somewhere, you know, and I was still there. And then I began to think, well, maybe I'm not such a disaster, you know. Maybe the way I'm approaching it was actually okay, because at the end of the day, I'm still around. Yeah. And I also remember Lama Yeshe. Lama Yeshe was very practical. You have a picture of Lama? Oh, yes, there's Lama. Okay. So I love those pictures of Lama smiling. Everybody thought Lama was so loving and smiling and joyful. If you were Lama's disciple for a period of time and were ordained, you realize that Lama wasn't always like that. Yeah, I remember, well, I'm getting off the topic, but I remember one time, you know, Lama was giving teachings in the tent at Kopan, yeah, and we were all sitting there. So there were all the new people, you know, and then there was some of us old people. And Lama, I forget what he was teaching now, and the new people laughing, laughing, laughing. Oh, Lama's so funny. And the rest of the old people were sitting there like, because we knew that he was scolding us. Yeah? Yeah, we knew that it was like, shape up, kids. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, that was a distraction. Back to it, what Lama used to say is, he said, you don't need all this fanfare. And he said, if somebody comes up to me and says, Lama, thank you for what you taught. It helped me when I practiced it. He said, that's good enough. That's, you know, relying on a spiritual mentor. You know, that's what he wanted, is for people to really take the teachings to heart and feel them. And, you know, and then if you do that, you automatically appreciate your teacher. You don't have to do all sorts of, you know, fancy stuff. Okay? Some people like doing fancy stuff. That's fine. There's no problem. Yeah? In fact, I'm very glad there's people who like to do fancy stuff, because I'm not a fancy person. And, you know, so, you know, when there's high lamas come, you know, you want lots of offerings. You want, like, beautiful flowers. You want gorgeous flower arrangements. There's one nun I know, she loves arranging flowers. She makes the most beautiful flower arrangements, you know. Sometimes she drives everybody crazy, in, you know, spending so much time getting the right flower and everything. But she does it with such real admiration and devotion. And I'm glad she does that, because I'm not into flower arrangement, you know? It's like the way I show my devotion is I'm editing some material on, and, you know, to print a Dharma book, to make a book. That's how I manifest my thing. And other people, I'm so glad they do it in other ways, because then, therefore, we have these beautiful, you know, environments to come into. Yeah. So, you know, everybody's going to show it in a different way. Yeah, and in a way that feels comfortable to us. But it has to be based on some reason, not just on charisma and glitz and somebody has a lot of names. Okay. Is that? Do you have other questions about that? Yeah.
I think it can sometimes be hard to reconcile that kind of reasoned trust or confidence in your teacher sometimes with the stories you read about, like, the Repa and the Ropa, you know, the things they would do for their teachers that just go beyond kind of the scope of reason.
Oh, okay.
It sounds romantic, and it's like, yeah, go build a 10-story building. It's like, yeah, I'll do that for my teacher. But then it's, I don't know. You know,
yeah, then you go there, and they ask you to wash a dish, and you say no.
Right.
You know?
It's that being, having the trust to be ready to do anything, I guess.
Yeah.
But then,
okay. Okay, so you're talking about these stories of, well, you know, Naropa going and seeing Talopa eating fish. And like, who's this guy? You know, he's a spiritual mentor and he's eating fish and throwing the bones on the ground, you know. But then Talopa made the fish come back alive again. So that convinced Naropa, you know. Or Talopa told Naropa to go jump off a cliff. And he did. Yeah. That doesn't mean we do that if our teacher tells us to jump off a cliff. Okay. His Holiness says, if you're the quality of disciple of Naropa or Milarepa, and your teacher is the quality of disciple like Talopa, or, you know, or Naropa, then you can do that. If you're both of comparable quality, the teacher and disciple. If not, then you have to, you know, do things within the realm of normal human behavior. Okay? So that's one part of it. Another part is what I'm getting from what you're asking is this side of us that feels I will do absolutely anything for our teacher. Yeah. So it's a beautiful feeling when we have it, you know. I remember having that, you know, it's like, I will do anything for my teacher. Yeah. And then realizing, yeah. There's things I have to also understand, yeah. Some things I can make sense to me automatically, and I do them. Some things I have to understand, or some things I have to check out the water first to make sure if that's suitable, yeah. And if I don't understand, I have to ask my teacher. Because if I don't understand, I'm not going to be able to sustain doing that task out of just blind faith. Yeah, my blind faith is not going to keep me doing it. Yeah, I need understanding. And so, you know, and they say in the scriptures, it's perfectly all right to go to your teacher and ask, you know, please explain more to me, or please clarify this to me. Because lots of times we misunderstand the instructions. Lots of times we go way to the extreme on the instructions, you know, and like make some kind of really extreme situation. I remember, here's a good example. Yeah, this was... So I had been living in Italy. I went back to India. I wanted to stay in India. Lama and Rinpoche told me to go back to Italy. I did not want to go back to Italy. But Lama and Rinpoche said to go. So, you know, I'm waiting for the center in Italy to send me a ticket. You know, I'm going to do what my teacher said. And I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And the center does not send me a ticket. And then I start going like, oh, no, I'm not fulfilling my teacher's instructions to go to Italy and help at this Dharma Center, you know. But they're not sending the ticket. Does that mean I should go buy the ticket myself and go there? And I got quite confused. And I happened to go see Ling Rinpoche about that time and asked him, you know, how do I follow my teacher's instructions? And he said, they're not sending you a ticket, you don't go. It was like, be practical, kid. You know, just be practical. Don't get in lost in some kind of, you know what I mean? That kind of thing. Yeah. And so also really trying to understand the purpose of certain instructions. And also to realize, because there's the famous line, Lama says, yeah. But, you know, Lama says different things to different people because different people need to hear different things. Achen Cha, a Theravada monk, expresses it very good. He says, if somebody's walking on a narrow path and there's cliffs on either side, if a person's walking too close to the right side, you say, go left, go left. If a person's walking too close to the left side, you say, go right, go right. Yeah? But if somebody comes out and says, well, what did they tell you to do? And one says, oh, you go right. And the other one says, no, he said, go left. Then you're going to quarrel about what to do because you're not understanding that advice is given in a context to a specific individual. You know, in a specific mental state. And often that advice is not necessarily crystal clear to us at the beginning. Or like I said, we make some kind of incredible rigid story about it. You know, example, in India, you know, around some of my teachers, you know, we all just wanted to hang out around the teacher. You know, it's like, we want to hang out, so we want to bring a cup of tea, you know, any reason to go into that room. And so, you know, Rinpoche or Lama says, bring me a cup of tea. And it's like, yes, and we run to the kitchen. Rinpoche wants a cup of tea, and I've got to make a cup of tea and get out of the way. I'm making a cup of tea for Rinpoche, for Lama, you know, get out of the way. No, you can't take it in. He asked me to bring him a cup of tea. Get out of here, you know? And you know, you criticize everybody, you fight with them all. I say, you got to take the cup of tea in last time, you know, you're thinking. Yeah, because you're so jealous of everybody else and really competitive with all the other disciples, you know. Yeah, oh my God, it's true. It's true. I've been in the scene, you know. And, or at least maybe I'm telling you about my mind. Yeah, and I was like, okay, now I got the cup of tea. And so you go in, and you're soft and gentle. And here, Rinpoche, have your cup of tea. You know, so you're so well behaved around your teacher. In the meantime, you know, you just elbowed everybody else out of the kitchen. Okay, because he told me to bring the cup of tea, so I've got to be the one to bring it in. You know, it's not that literal, yeah, when he says, please bring me a cup of tea. It just means I need something to drink. You know, anybody can give me a cup of tea. It doesn't have to, you know, we don't have to make it this solid concrete thing, you know, with the middle of I, with I in the middle of it, you know. Okay. Yeah. And so we also, you know, I mean, this 9-story building or 10-story building that Miller referenced. Yes, oh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that, you know, for my teacher. And then we ask our teacher, what do you want me to do? And they tell us something, and it's not what we want to do. And it's not glamorous and you know, romantic. And anyway, even if they asked us to build a 9-story building, you know, when you start to do it, it's not glamorous and romantic, is it? Yeah. You want me to build a 9-story building? Oh, God. Listen, Milarepa had it easy moving those stones. I have to deal with a contractor. You know? Milarepa didn't have to deal with a contractor. He was easy. Oh, it's easy, you know. So, you getting what I'm saying? Yeah.
So, going back to the point, depending on the spiritual mentor, like, I grew up Catholic in a Catholic school, so we always were told the Pope is right, the Pope is right. So, coming into Buddhism, it's hard to kind of like, when you look at the Dalai Lama, you're like, is this like that same kind of relationship, like when they're trying to tell you when you're, you know, when you're younger, like the Pope is right, the Pope is right. How do you like translate that and to see this person in a different light, in a different understanding?
So are you talking about, because you were so inculcated with the Pope is right, that it's hard then to have faith in anybody else beside the Pope? Oh, yeah, he's like the Pope. So, okay. You know, the Buddha himself said you have to understand the teachings and test them. And he used an example about testing gold, you know, by rubbing it and cutting it and burning it. I don't know about gold, but apparently these are ways in which you see the quality of the gold, if it's pure gold or not. And this is what the Buddha said you have to do with the teachings, not just, you know, accept, oh, it's gold. It's, you know, no, you test it. And the thing is, you know, if you go to listen to His Holiness teach, if you really think about what He says, you know, and after you learn a while, you know, from different teachers, and then you go to His Holiness, and you see how He's teaching, it just blows you away. Yeah, because He's, you know, I'm telling you, you know, but that's not reason enough for you to have faith. You have to see for yourself. But my experience is He brings in points from so many different scriptures and so many different topics, and His way of weaving things together and making things come together is really exceptional. Yeah. But you have to like know the teachings, and then you really see that. Or even you go and you don't know the teachings, you know, you think about what He says. Yeah. 'Cause I know for me, this was one of the big things, you know. My teachers at the very beginning, they said ignorance, anger, and attachment are defilements, and they're the cause of your unsatisfactory condition. And I thought, yeah, anger is a big problem. When other people get angry at me, they're really wrong, and they shouldn't be angry, you know? And other people are so greedy, and that's why this country is falling apart, and they're so ignorant. You know, well, no, it wasn't really others' ignorance, anger, and attachment He was talking about. It was mine. So, you know, I had to get that through my own thick skull. But when I began to really look at my own life and see how my own anger functioned, how my own attachment functioned, how my own ignorance, then I said, oh, wow, this is really true. Yeah, the problem is not other living beings. The problem is the mental states in here. Yeah. And that's what, you know, kind of gave a source of faith or confidence that no matter what has happened after that, there's no way, you know, that it's like, you know, because your ego's always trying to find some way why you can't, some reason why you can't practice. You know? Yeah. Ego ego does not readily submit. It doesn't roll over and play dead. It fights back, and it comes up with all these good reasons why you can't practice or why some teaching is just not correct. Yeah. But for me, that was the one teaching, you know, identifying the three poisonous attitudes as the source of problems, that my ego hasn't been able to find a way around that. I have tried to blame other living beings, and I still blame other living beings. But at the end of the day, even after I blame them, it's like, work on here, kiddo. You know, work on here. It's not outside. Yeah. And so that kind of understanding is, you know, keeps you going on the path. And it's really made me appreciate my teachers so much, because nobody else ever told me that before. Everybody, in fact, told me the opposite. Yeah. They said, go and get a lot of stuff. Look out for yourself, because nobody's going to look out for yourself. Yeah. Trample on the people who get in your way. But you're a woman, so you can't look like you're trampling on them. Yeah. You've got to look otherwise, but you have to do that anyway. Right? Isn't that the message we get? Yeah? So, yeah. So they really opened my eyes to something, and I'm incredibly grateful to that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I just want to go back a second to your example about the flight ticket to Italy. Uh-huh. And was wondering if you had any advice in sort of discerning between what I would call obstacles on the path and signs. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, obstacles on the path and signs. I don't know that I have any good advice about that, except when you're trying to really do something virtuous and you have a really good intention, you know, sometimes a lot of obstacles will come up. Yeah. In terms of signs that it's not meant to be, this term meant to be, I have difficulties with, because it sounds to me like it means somebody else means it to be. Somebody else is governing the situation. But in Buddhism, nobody else is governing the situation. Yeah? So it's kind of like, you know, trying to discern, you know, what is virtuous, what's not virtuous. What are the causes and conditions to do? What aren't there the causes and conditions to do? In this situation, maybe there aren't the causes and conditions right now, but if I try some other alternatives, they will come. Maybe in another situation, if I try other alternatives, it's going really way too far out and it's not worthwhile. Okay, so I don't know that there's any clear way. But I don't think things are meant to be, because there's nobody in the universe who's managing it who has the grand master plan. Yeah, things happen due to causes. It's pure causality. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk about being a spiritual person? And in Buddhism, we have an emphasis on logic. But there's also an element that happens from a lot of practice where you naturally develop a deeper sense of intuition. Can you talk about using your intuition and also logic and how you marry those, being someone who's practiced for so long?
Okay. Okay, so how you put intuition and logic together when you've practiced for a while. Intuition is a funny kind of word because I'm never quite sure what it means. Yeah. It, for me, it kind of means you have a feeling about something. But I also know that very often my feelings are about something are not correct. Yeah. I'll feel like something's going to happen. It never happens. You know? Are you talking more about like making decisions in your life based on reason and logic, or about understanding the Dharma and gaining realizations? What's the context of your question?
I feel like those two things are very close to me. Mm-hmm. For me, those two things are married together. Mm-hmm. In Vajrayana practice, when you try to see all things as the mandala, and then the mandala begins to speak to you in particular ways, do you see what I'm trying to go with it? Like, how do you...
Okay, I kind of get what you're saying. I think in that sense, if, you know, you gave the example, if you're meditating on the mandala and then you start getting certain intuitions or you think it's speaking to you in certain ways. I think you have to put that together with also where reasoning is leading you. You know, it's like you can listen to that, but it can't be contradictory to reason. On the other hand, we can't stick so much to reason that we never give anything else the benefit of the doubt. Okay? You know, on some things we have to just kind of open, like, I don't have it totally worked out, but that sounds really reasonable. And I give it the benefit of the doubt and I incorporate it into my worldview. But then there's other things, like I said, you know, I'll get feelings like this is going to happen or that or whatever. And I'm aware of them, but I don't believe in them 100%. Because I've also noticed that sometimes my feelings are way off. And I have to pay attention to the present situation, because if I believe so much in my intuition, then I'm not paying attention to the present situation. Do you get what I'm meaning? It's like, oh, I have this intuition about this, and so I think this, 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 this. Meanwhile, reality is in front of me, and I'm not looking at it. And my intuition has turned into a daydream. Yeah. So I find I have to be careful of that. At the same time, you know, you pay attention to different things, different thoughts that you have, and then you try and kind of work them out and to see if it bears water, you know? At least that's how I work with it. Okay? I know people have very different mixes of this, you know? There's some people who really go with their dreams and go with their intuition and go with all of that. And it's quite interesting, you know, in Tibetan circles themselves, because when you're taking a highest class tantra initiation, the day before the initiation, they tell you to watch your dreams, you know, that night, because it could give you some indication. So then everybody goes home and we have our kusa grass and we put it out. We all watch our dreams, and next day, what did you dream? What did you dream? What did you dream? And we're all looking for signs in our dreams. And then the lama will get up there and say, well, these kind of dreams are auspicious and these kind of dreams are inauspicious. And we're all like looking at our dreams and what am I dreaming? You know, because it's my dream after all. You know, it's my dream. You know, and what does this mean? And then at the end of it, he says, but, you know, it was just a dream. Yeah. So it's quite interesting, this thing of, yeah. I mean, and it is just a dream. It is just a thought. It is just intuition. On the other hand, sometimes, you know, it may indicate something. On the other hand, sometimes it doesn't. I don't know if that was a very adequate answer. Yeah, I think everybody's going to kind of feel it out for themselves in a different way. Okay, so it's time for us to take a break. We went over time. So, isn't that terrible? So how about if we come back at 2:10, so you have an hour and a half? Okay. And so come back with the questions and the topics that you want to go into, and then we'll talk some more about those, okay?